Okay, I think we'll get started. Good evening to everybody. I'm Christine Chinkin. I know lots of you in the room already, but I'm director of the newly established Centre for Women, Peace and Security, which was established earlier this year here at the LSE as a centre in the Institute for Global Affairs. So, first of all, delighted to welcome you all here this evening. And for this event, which is entitled CEDAW Today, Evolutions and Challenges in a Conflict-Affected World. Now, this is co-hosted by the Centre and by the Austrian Embassy in London, and I'm especially delighted to welcome members from the Embassy here this evening and to thank you both for the sort of general support for the Centre and particularly for co-hosting this evening tonight and making it possible for us to have Dr. Hofmeister here in London with us. So, very special thank you to it all. Right, before introducing the speakers and the event for tonight, a couple of standard housekeeping notices that you hear at every single lecture but we have to go through. There is no fire drill scheduled for this evening, so if the fire alarms go, we have to respond, you know, accordingly. Could you please all silence telephones? And if you want to use Twitter, something that is completely beyond my imagination, but anyway, if you want to Twitter during the event, the hashtag is up here, and obviously you're welcome to do so. The event is being recorded, and hopefully, technology permitting and so on, the podcast will be posted on the website of the Women, Peace and Security. Okay, now the format for the event this evening is that our first speaker, Jane Connors, on my right, she will provide a 15-minute or so, I think, overview of the development and evolution of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, commonly known as either the Women's Convention or CEDAW. She will be followed by our second speaker, Dr. Lillian Hofmeister, who will then speak for around 20 minutes or so.
15, 20.
The shorter you speak, the more questions. who will focus on current challenges with respect to the guarantee of women's human rights. Then, of course, we'll have the usual question discussion process following that. The event will finish at around 8, no later than 8 o'clock, and everybody is invited to join the speakers at a reception, which will be on the 8th floor, again, generously hosted by the Austrian Embassy. Now, as many of you know, and you've also got the leaflet that tells you this, the Centre for Women, Peace and Security is to promote discussion and research on combating gender-based violence, in particular including in armed conflict. Now, our focus tonight is on CEDAW, which is the United Nations flagship on women's human rights. It was adopted in 1979 and today has 189 states parties, I believe. Yes? Which makes it the second most widely accepted UN human rights treaty. Most widely accepted is the Children's Convention, which has 193 or 194 states parties. So, you know, the Women's Convention is right up there. It's also one of the most innovative human rights treaties, with the, I think, revolutionary objective of achieving transformative equality between women and men. Now, what is interesting about the CEDAW Convention in light of our particular discussion tonight is that it doesn't directly address either violence or conflict. But the CEDAW Committee, the monitoring committee established by the Convention, has over a number, well, ever since its creation, essentially, worked through the adoption of general recommendations and jurisprudence to make the Convention, in the committee's own words, a living instrument, and so to bring it constantly evolving with respect to changing circumstances. But in 1992, the committee became the first international body to address seriously states' obligations with respect to the elimination of such violence against women, the adoption of General Recommendation 19, which recognized that such violence is rooted in discrimination and unequal power relations between women and men. And while we're talking about general recommendation, or at least while I'm talking about general recommendation number 19, I'd also like to welcome especially a very particular guest, Elizabeth Evatt, who has long been one of my absolute idols, was a member of the CEDAW committee in 1992, and I think one of the driving forces, if not the driving force, behind general recommendation number 19. She was a member of the committee, chair of the committee as well, and then became a member of the Human Rights Committee. And Elizabeth, it's absolute honour to have you here this evening. So, tonight we're going to hear from two other experts on the committee and its evolution and its current work. So I'm delighted to welcome both of the speakers to the London School of Economics, and I'll now introduce them in turn. So Jane Connors, I've known Jane for a very long time, and we've had, I don't know, many, many conversations about CEDAW over the years. First at SOAS, where you were a lecturer, then in New York, and most recently in Geneva, in both situations working in the United Nations Human Rights, which keeps changing its name from division, office, etc., but essentially within, most recently, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, essentially working on the treaty body system, in particular CEDAW, and knows an enormous amount about CEDAW, has written extensively on the treaty bodies in general, human rights of women in particular. And on my left, Dr. Lillian Hofmeister, who is a human rights expert from Austria and is a current member of the Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, so can tell us what is happening in the committee at present. She's a particular expert in the field of advancement of women's human rights, women's access to justice, and in particular discrimination against women. She also serves as a substitute justice at the Austrian Constitutional Court. So welcome to both of you. And I'll turn without further ado to Jane.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me here, particularly for all your help and Zoe for helping me. I'm also very grateful to the Austrian ambassador and his colleagues for convening with Christine the event. And I'm also very grateful that we have a current committee member with us, and she's much better placed than I am to talk about the committee's current work. I'm going to talk about, I'll put things in a couple of tranches. I'm going to start from the Charter to the Convention, because we're all gearing up, I hope, for the 24th of October. It will be 70 years on that day since the UN Charter entered into force. And you all know what it looks like. I'm sure you're studying it. It starts unforgettably with "We the peoples of the United Nations." It reaffirms faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, and the equal rights of men and women. And there are two other articles which proclaim that promoting and encouraging respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms for all without distinction, including on the basis of sex, is one of the UN's purposes. There's also an article which establishes the organisation as an equal opportunity employer, and 70 years have passed and it hasn't really got that far with that element. But anyway, we look forward to something improving. Now, women's rights had been addressed by international organisations and multilateral treaties before the Charter, but in 1945 these provisions, and they seem modest, were the most forceful affirmation of equality and non-discrimination in the enjoyment of rights. They're also the basis of the international legal framework and institutions for the promotion and protection of women's human rights. And I won't go through the 1948 Declaration of Human Rights with its statements with respect to women's rights, nor will I go through the twin covenants on economic, social and cultural and civil and political rights. They form the foundation of the binding framework that we have. But And they were followed by treaties on specific areas where women were denied human rights, these treaties being formulated by the Commission on the Status of Women, those being politics, nationality of married women, and consent to minimum age for and registration of marriage. Those were elaborated very much in the post-Second World War years, as they were areas which were very clear as being areas where women had been denied their human rights, and it became very obvious in the post-conflict world. Those treaties and the instruments, the ones we call the general instruments, and the treaties developed in the Commission on the Status of Women were light on ratification, very heavy on reservations, and they remain that today. These treaties had minimal impact on entrenched and emerging discrimination against women in law and practice. So to address this, the General Assembly in 1963 requested the Commission on the Status of Women to prepare a draft declaration on the elimination of discrimination against women, which consolidated all the UN standards on women's rights. The task was limited to consolidate those standards, but it proved to be extremely difficult, and it proved to be very, very difficult in the areas of equality of women with men in marriage, the family, and employment. And you should think about that, because if we think about areas where there are difficulties today, equality of women with men and marriage and family law and employment is up there very high. The declaration was unanimously adopted in November 1967, and I was a UN bureaucrat for 18 and a half years. We're always very upbeat about these sorts of results. This was a non-binding instrument. This was an instrument which was fairly modest, and it failed to generate the state voluntary reporting set up to track its implementation. But if you look at it, its 11 articles are remarkable given the political context. We had Cold War, decolonisation, and fixed stereotypical views of the role of women in public and private life, especially the family. These were resurgent after the Second World War. Ironically, its success is more in the fact that it was a failure. Because it was a failure, it was thought that it would be very useful to codify its provisions in binding treaty form. And that was the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Preparation of that convention took 10 years. And the topics in the preamble, and have a look at the preamble later, you'll find things like the new economic, international economic order, you'll find various other issues that really mark it as a Cold War treaty par excellence. Elimination of discrimination against women in law, rights in marriage and family, again, education, bank loans and credit were contentious. And there were procedural issues that were a problem as well. The oversight and implementation measures, reservations, etc. And as you've heard from Christine, on the 18th of December 1979, the Assembly adopted this convention by a vote of 130 to none with 11 abstentions. You shouldn't get too excited about that. It looks like a good result. But it's always useful to look at what is said on adoption. And what was said on adoption wasn't very attractive, and 40 countries expressed reservations on specific provisions. Now, like the non-distinction equality paragraphs in the Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Covenants and the CSW treaties, the Convention resulted from the determination of women's rights activists. And despite the many commentators who suggest otherwise, from all regions, backgrounds and legal traditions, consisting of members inside and outside governments, and also within the UN, to ensure that a framework setting out women's human rights and the obstacles to achieving their full implementation was at the core of international human rights law. The influence of women's rights activists outside and inside the UN, and they move between these roles, as Christine can tell you, is a recurrent theme in UN standard setting and policy making, including with the Declaration on the Elimination of Violence Against Women, the optional protocol to CEDAW, and the creation of mechanisms such as the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and the Working Group on Discrimination Against Women in Law and Practice. This influence has also been crucial in the evolution of the committee and mainstreaming of human rights of women in the UN's human rights work more generally, such as the Security Council agenda, the Sustainable Development Goals, the work on climate change. Another recurrent and resurgent theme is the divergent positions on women's equality in marriage and family law. Now, the convention is almost 36 years old. It's a product of its time. Christine's very upbeat about it. But it is modelled on the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, and it's modelled on it in orientation and language. It defines discrimination against women, drawing very heavily on the language of the Race Convention definition of racial discrimination. And what it does, predominantly, is elaborates the measures states' parties should fulfil to meet their obligation to eliminate discrimination in the enjoyment of the full range of rights. If we were drafting it today, and all I can say to you is whatever we drafted would never be adopted, we would start with a document on the lines of the Convention on the Rights of the Child or the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, because they set out rights. This elaborates non-discrimination against women on the basis of sex. But the definition is important in that it encompasses purposeful and effective discrimination against women on the basis of sex, irrespective of their marital status. And that's allowed the committee to develop the concept of substantive equality, requiring not only that a state's laws, policies and programs avoid direct or indirect discrimination, but also that it ensures that women enjoy, in fact and reality, the same opportunities and privileges as men. The treaty's overarching obligation is that states' parties, without delay, pursue a policy of eliminating discrimination against women, and it defines legislation and other measures required to achieve that end. These may include carefully designed temporary special measures, such as affirmative action, including quotas, even though people don't like quotas, aimed at accelerating de facto equality between women and men, which are defined as non-discriminatory and also defined as temporary, and often people forget that temporary. Several features of the convention are notable. Article 5 obliges states' parties to take all appropriate measures to modify the social and cultural patterns of conduct of women and men to eliminate prejudices and customary and other practices based on ideas of the inferiority or superiority of either of the sexes or on stereotype roles for women and men. That requires the transformation of states, the transformation of communities and families so as to achieve full gender equality. It sets out the objectives necessary for states to eliminate discrimination against women and ensure their equality with men in the political, economic, social, cultural, civil or other fields. And this includes it amongst the first human rights treaties to incorporate the concepts of universality, indivisibility, and interdependence of all human rights. It bridges human rights and development, especially through requiring states' parties to take all appropriate measures to eliminate discrimination against rural women and ensure that they participate in and benefit from rural development on an equal basis with men. And that's the only provision in a human rights treaty on rural women. And like CERD, it breaches the public-private divide in terms of state obligation. But it goes further, requiring states' parties to take all appropriate measures to eliminate discrimination against women by any person, organisation and enterprise. And that applies to that most private of private spheres, marriage and family life. Christine has told you about how many states' parties we have. The stragglers are the Holy See, Iran, Palau, Somalia, Sudan, Tonga, and surprise, surprise, the United States. Now, the committee. Let's look at its evolution. It establishes a committee of 23 members, nominated and elected by states' parties, but serving in their individual capacity to assist states' parties in implementation. From its very first session, which convened on the 18th of October 1982 in Vienna, so we're moving towards another anniversary, the committee was different from the three brother or sister treaty bodies that existed at that time and those which followed. It was the largest. All but one of its members were women, and over that period of time, the 35 years or so that the committee's been kicking along, there have only been four men, and one ran off quite soon. Most of the people who were on the committee had very, very strong feminist credentials, so I did write a paper once for them and they asked me to take the word feminist out. And the majority was set on interpreting the treaty dynamically. The convention also was drafted by the Commission on the Status of Women, not the Commission on Human Rights, and it was to the former to which its reports were transmitted for information. The committee also found itself with limited meeting time, the only human rights treaty which limited the meeting time of the treaty body to 2 weeks annually. Its mandate was very confined, consideration of states' parties' reports. Its secretariat was small and not part of the Centre for Human Rights, now the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. And it met alternately in New York, not Geneva, isolating it from what some call the human rights mainstream. It also had to deal with more reservations to the substance of the convention, many directed to equality between women and men in private life than its sister brother bodies. Now, I see the committee as evolving in three stages, and I realise I'm running out of time. Its first 10 years, consolidation, and second stage, consolidation and becoming an integral part of the human rights mainstream, or, as I say, poor relation no more. Cinderella. And full mandate.
Hmm? Cinderella, you said once.
Yes, and I wasn't allowed to publish that. it's under a different name, that article. And full mandate and confidence. In the first 10 years, the committee developed its working methods, grappled with internal divisions, and Elizabeth is here, so she'll be able to talk about that. Often those resulted from Cold War politics, in particular on whether it was empowered to formulate general recommendations on convention articles and cross-cutting themes. And here it was very unlucky because its secretariat did not want it to do anything like that, and the Office of Legal Affairs made it very clear that it thought it had no power to do that. And it struggled for more meeting time and resources. On substance, it went through a very rocky period. Or not rocky, it was a good period, but rocky for some. It tackled states' parties on reservations. It called for studies on progressive interpretation of Islamic law. That made it extremely famous, but very unpopular, and issued 18 generally tentative general recommendations, the most substantive, most of them based on trends gleaned from consideration of reports. But its work captured the imagination of women in many countries and at many levels during that first 10 years, and it gained strong civil society following, especially through its interface with the UN World Conferences and CSW. The second stage coincides more or less with the lead-up and immediate follow-up to the 1993 Vienna World Conference on Human Rights, and we're lucky, Vienna, Austria, and the Fourth World Conference on Women. And it saw its resources and meeting time strengthened. It saw it align its working methods to those of its sister-brother bodies, or often they're aligning themselves with its working methods, especially where progressive practices were concerned, such as civil society participation. Full acceptance of its competence to develop and adopt general recommendations with its groundbreaking General Recommendation 19 on violence against women being a contribution to the Vienna Conference, and I think that linkage is quite important. But also this stage sees the entry into force of the Convention's optional protocol, now accepted by 106 states' parties, investing it with competence to receive and consider petitions from individuals and undertake inquiries. Now, I'll finish by saying the committee is now very confident in its full mandate. It continues to work with the convention flexibly as a living instrument to be interpreted as relevant to the concerns of all women in all parts of the world, and it states this in all its general recommendations. Nonetheless, it's practical and pragmatic when it deals with states. Its general recommendations are now elaborated transparently with wide input. They're detailed and comprehensive. And they build very much on General Recommendation 19, which is mentioned in succeeding general recommendations. That general recommendation has had a lot of effect outside the committee. It has been used by international and regional mechanisms and the seven Security Council resolutions on women, peace and security, I don't think would exist without it, and also by legislatures and judiciaries. And the committee has been very outspoken with regard to topical issues addressing statements on these areas. Its most concrete expression of its evolution is its work on petitions and inquiries. And in question and answer, I can talk about some of those if you wish to know about it. As you can see, I could talk about the impact and CEDAW for hours, and you probably wouldn't want me to talk for hours. I've just started, and I could move on further. I'll just finishing on challenges. We've got a difficult world today. Human rights enjoyment is really under threat, and women's rights enjoyment is particularly under threat. And we have this, well, it's not a resurgence, but it's always been there, like a little headache, which has now resurged, that human rights are not necessarily universal, but should be interpreted through a lens of culture, custom, tradition, and religion. And that's a view which often resonates in discussions of the rights of women and girls, especially in the family. Now, we're all very excited, I suppose, because the Sustainable Development Goals, which give us an agenda to 2030 when everything's going to be wonderful. And we're all really excited that there's goal 5, achieve gender equality and empower all women and girls. And one wonders how that is going to be done. But it's disheartening, and nobody ever tells you to do this, to read the views of states on the adoption of the Sustainable Development Goals, which occurred during the 69th session of the General Assembly. Most of you will look at the 70th session, where everybody was enthusiastic. And there you'll find that the African group, the Gulf Cooperation States, Iran and the Holy See express distressing views with regard to sexual and reproductive health, the meaning of gender, the family, and there is a profound rejection of notions of equality with regard to persons of LGBTI status. And there's very tentative support. There are some, I mean, the US is pretty tough, and it's quite interesting because it hasn't ratified CEDAW, for women's human rights and gender equality. These are issues, this resurgent business, often pops up in conflict and transition. Now, clearly the convention applies in these contexts. Human rights applies in conflict, in transition, just as international humanitarian law applies. And I think these are things we have to think about and consider how we address them. And you're best placed because you're young and chirpy. And you'll be around as we move to 2030. And you might be able to deal with these little issues that are raised at the adoption of those wonderful SDGs. Thank you. And I'm terribly sorry to take so long.
Thank you, Jane. I was about to say you did a great overview of 70 years history from the UN, but then you added on the last 15 years as well. So I presume that makes it 85 years, sort of back to the future or something as well. But thank you, that was a great overview. And now I turn to Lillian for a discussion of what you see as some of the challenges and issues with respect to CEDAW today. So thank you.
Excellency, distinguished audience, dear Christine, many thanks for the invitation. I'm a newcomer to CEDAW Committee. I was elected in June 2014 and started in January 2015. So I cannot tell about the CEDAW Committee so absolutely straight, but I'm also not an expert in conflicts and wars, but I will tell you about my experience with CEDAW as a feminist. I am the first Austrian woman who is member of CEDAW committee, although the first CEDAW meeting was in Vienna in 1982, we learned, and I'm the first. Austria is slow, but Austria likes to support human rights, especially women's rights. War instead of peace. The patriarchate as a structure behind the structures. Peace is unable to rule. In German, der Friede ist nicht herrschaftsfähig. This was roughly a brief version of what we were told by a female German military sociologist decades ago on the occasion of her lecture in Vienna to guide us on our feministic way through the jungle of social norms and instances. At the time, I was not aware of the connection between a warrior society and the patriarchate. Only much later, when I came across the book by the famous Austrian historian Gerda Lerner, The Creation of Patriarchy in the 90s, did I suddenly gain an understanding of why peace in reality was and is not a category of social action, but that any time period could only be a post-war period and, from an ex-post perspective, a pre-war period. As you know, Austria and Germany have many painful experiences with war, since both countries were responsible for and lost World War II, and both countries were battlefields. According to Gerda Lerner, the patriarchate is the structure behind all structures and can be described as the rule of old men as defined by Horst Hermann, a German theologian and philosopher. They have the power to define so-called patronomy and rule out everybody else, especially all women and children, but also young men. This is called exclusion. By creating hierarchies, they achieve a vertical structure of society, not depending on qualifications, in the sense of an unfair ranking order. They were and are cross-linked and enjoy information advantages. To justify their rule, they pursue lobbying and exert pressure up to violence. They spread prejudices and despise those who are at the bottom of the ranking order. They wield massive influence on education of children and adolescents to give rise to the omnipresent impression that in this society everything is in order anyway, and this top-bottom structure is inherent, meaning perfectly natural and typical of human coexistence. From Joachim Bauer, a German neurobiologist, and Ernst Fehr, an Austrian economist, we learned that supporting the theory of Charles Darwin, The Origin of Species, who told us about mutation and selection, cooperation between humans was the main thing why mankind is still alive. Cooperation, not competition and bad communication. Today, nearly all societies worldwide suffer under this invisible yoke, regardless to ethnic group, political organization, system of government, or religion. Exclusion and the creation of hierarchies as means to establish the patriarchate are measures profoundly contradicting human nature, which is fundamentally altruistic. Disseminating and maintaining hatred and discord between women and men within the families and in other social groups. Or, in other words, there is a permanent war on a small scale in this warrior society. In globalist world society, which seems to have replaced belligerent colonialism, having started from Europe in former times, by economic means of conquest, war means big business, with the opportunity offered by arms trade and human trafficking. For me, these circumstances are the explanation why all over the world so many wars are fought at the same time and are kept ongoing. gender-based hierarchy in times of globalization, Article 5, small a, CEDAW. In my opinion, this provision is the key element of this convention. It is the provision which formulates the obligation of state parties to take consistently all appropriate measures to eliminate stereotyped roles which are based on the idea of the inferiority of women and girls and to eradicate prejudices. The book Gender Stereotyping Transnational Legal Perspectives deals with this subject from the legal point of view. In the introduction, Louis Arbour writes, "Within a country, stereotyping is liable to pervade different sectors of national life, whether it be in the education, employment or health service, marriage or family relations or other areas of national life. While the content of stereotypes might vary according to countries and sectors, they generally function to contribute to systemic beliefs that justify women's subordination in society. Gender hierarchy means unequal power relation and serves to maintain this power distribution to the detriment of women and girls. The worldwide economization of all areas of life caused by capitalism made the situation even worse. Thus, it is not surprising that many countries have little to include in their reports to the CEDAW Committee on Article 5, small a, or misunderstand the provision. The good and the better life, for whom? Many scientific disciplines, such as philosophy, theology, sociology, physiology, psychology, but also economics and political sciences, deal with happiness research. As a result, different answers are to be found on how to achieve best possible common well-being by political action. The subject is more topical than ever before, since TV, internet, social networks, and cell phones spread pictures and text every day, even to the smallest village of the planet, so that people living in poverty too obtain knowledge thereof. Generally speaking, happiness and the good life are not only understood as a personal feeling of well-being, but also as the interaction of favorable factors such as welfare, harmony with the environment, harmony with fellow humans, and safeguarding of good living conditions for generations to come. But there are also further-reaching considerations. For instance, Bhutan objectifies and measures the satisfaction of its citizens on the basis of so-called gross national happiness. German sociologist Hartmut Rosa mentions the concepts of welfare, education, status, distribution of resources, etc., as indicators of well-being. In brief, it is a matter of life working out well. It is clear that, above all, parents want to offer their children such a life. And it is self-evident that parents, themselves living in poverty and need, hope that their children will have a better life. When in summer 2015, thousands of people fled across the Mediterranean Sea and over the Balkans to the rich countries of Western Europe, this migration still continues. They were often interviewed by the media and answered the question what had led them to Europe repeatedly. We only want a better life for our children. This is what people also said who fled from persecution, for instance, from Syria. I hope they will find better arguments in their asylum proceedings, because otherwise they will have legal problems being treated as so-called economic refugees or migrants. I personally consider this distinction arbitrary. In my opinion, the correct legal answer would be, in addition to the right of asylum guaranteed by international law, the creation of uniform immigration legislation in the European countries, which adequately takes the wishes of immigrants and the interests of the respective host country into account. A better life for everybody. The MDGs and SDGs should be broken down effectively and worldwide to the national level and be implemented. Examples of instruments under international law coordinated by the UN and current tools of interpretation. The UN World Conference on Women in 1995 produced two remarkable results, which are, however, not legally binding: the Beijing Declaration and the Platform for Action. I had the honor to participate in text negotiations within the framework of the Austrian government delegation. In particular, Article 14 of the Beijing Declaration is a milestone because it defines women's rights as human rights. Thus, it picks up on the international development which had started since the UN Human Rights Conference in Vienna in 1993, under the pressure of many women's NGOs and well-known female and legal experts. The Platform for Action, in turn, formulated directions for activities in the course of national implementation of women's rights as human rights in member states, and also examined armed conflicts as cause and source of most serious human rights violation committed against women and girls. In November 2014, the symposium Enhancing Women's Share in Peace and Security took place in Vienna, attracting great attention. The event referred prominently to UN Security Council Resolution 1325 from 2000. The policy paper reads, with reference to those three instruments: these documents recognized for the first time the disproportionate and unique impact of armed conflict on women, as well as, in particular, their important role as active agents of change in the promotion and maintenance of peace and security. The current situation is described as follows. Numerous challenges remain: grave abuses and violence against women, including sexual violence and rape, continue to be a common occurrence in conflict and post-conflict settings all around the world. Special attention, Jane said, spoke about this, is to be paid on the optional protocol to the CEDAW, which resulted in an essential extension of procedures before the CEDAW committee. It entered into force in 2000 and had been drawn up with Austria's significant participation. Two further procedures were now added to the reporting procedure, that is the communications procedure and the inquiry procedure. Both procedures are today important areas of work fulfilled by CEDAW committee and are suitable to increase pressure on the state parties to make them enter into an implementation in accordance with the convention. The so-called general recommendations are of particular importance. They are important tools of interpretation for the CEDAW committee and increase the understanding of links shown by the signatory states. Some of them may be mentioned. Number 19, 1992, violence against women. It was so important and groundbreaking because the CEDAW fails to cover violence expressis verbis. Therefore, it was necessary to state in an interpretation in accordance with Article 1 of the Convention. Discrimination includes gender-based violence, that is, violence that is directed against a woman because she is a woman, or that affects women disproportionately. South Korean former member of CEDAW Committee, Ms. Hae-soo Shin, called the subject of violence against women the missing link. In the book, The Circle of Empowerment, also Jane is a co-author in this book. We notice with pleasure that the CEDAW Committee only recently decided an update of this general recommendation chaired by Feride Aca from Turkey. I am myself a member of the corresponding working group. But this general recommendation is nearly perfect, and so I'm not sure that we will be so successful like you. Number 30, on women in conflict prevention, conflict and post-conflict situation. A very important work, you can see here. It's very difficult to read, and it's very long, yes, but it's perhaps it's it will have a success. Number 32, on the gender-related dimension of refugee status, asylum, nationality, and statelessness of women. Number 33, on women's access to justice. Seen in their context, all three recommendations are an attempt to give a highly differentiated answer to international development during the past 20 years, coordinated by the UN. They broaden and equally deepen possible applications of the CEDAW as a female jurist and a practitioner who was a judge for decades in Austria. Allow me, nevertheless, to have my doubts about the concrete feasibility to implement the CEDAW on the eve of armed conflicts and during a war. In my opinion, legal framework conditions mainly play a role in times of peace, and only if a considerable part of the population believe in legal structures for life contexts and are willing to comply with the same themselves, so-called acceptance. These are the reasons why I don't believe in this development. This is why I consider peace initiatives urgent and indispensable. Number 31, general recommendation number 31 and general comment number 18. I would like to point out this special feature. For the first time, the CEDAW Committee and the CRC Committee published a joint text relating to harmful practices, also a milestone. Conclusion. How do we move on from here? Peace instead of war. Shulamit Koenig, the famous Israeli human rights activist, told me the following sentence: peace is not a right of domination, and peace doesn't break out. Yes? War breaks out. Peace doesn't break out. Whether in families or on the world stage, in times of war, women and girls are subject of even worse discrimination than in times of peace. Armed warlike and civil war attacks, flight and expulsion, statelessness, forced prostitution, trafficking in women, unbearable conditions in refugee camps, legal and factual barriers in the countries of arrival, fires in refugee accommodations and other evils torture women and girls, making them even more vulnerable as they were in their countries of origin anyway. In peace initiatives and during the reconstruction of their countries of origin, they hardly play a role to this day. This cannot continue, floods of refugees to Europe woke up many a member of the European Fund Society. But political concepts seem to be missing, and help is mainly left to civil society. For me, the misery of people in crisis regions is privatized, even if we once have learned that private matters are also political. Sometimes I'm asked, I'm a Christian, what I believe in. I often answer, I also believe in life before death, not only after death, in the sense of a good life for everybody. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. I think you've certainly set out some challenges and some perplexing thoughts, I think, things that we really need to think about, and how human rights treaties provide perhaps one way but can only be seen in this much broader context or contexts that you've been discussing. And if we're talking historically, you went right back to Charles Darwin, probably even earlier. Okay, over to you. So we'll take sort of questions and discussion. I'll take questions sort of two or three at a time before handing back to Jane and Lillian. There's a roving mic. And could you please give your name and relevant affiliation before you ask your question or make your comment, and please keep them fairly brief. So, thank you.
Hi, I'm Katie. I'm a student here at LSE. This is a question for you, Dr. Hofmeister. It's a very simple question. How many people are on the CEDAW committee, and how many of them are women?
How many people are in the CEDAW committee?
Yeah.
23.
Okay, and how many are women?
22. I didn't understand.
How many are women? 22. How many people?
Sorry,
women.
I'm sick.
How many? 22
women.
Okay.
One man.
Okay.
He is a legal expert from Finland and specialized in labor law.
Okay.
And he thinks that labor law is the key science for women, and I don't believe.
Why don't you believe?
No, because there are all over the world, there are so many women who have no job. Or they have a job in a country where there is no labor law. Or they have a job in a country where labor law is, but her job is not, or their job is not under labor law, yes? Or she has a job in a country where there is a labor law, but it is also for her, but she is not successful in judiciary, perhaps, or in her surrounding, yes? And so I think only a small part of women are under labor law, and all others not. Especially rural women are often not under labor law, and they are the most vulnerable group of women worldwide. Yes, that's my problem.
Okay, other questions. Right, quite a number coming up. We'll take first, as you're holding the microphone, but we'll take the three. One, two, three. Yeah.
Great. Okay, so this, I think, applies to both of you, both from a historical perspective as well as sort of moving forward. It seems that the value of women's participation really can't be oversold in terms of working through some of these like major global issues. And so I was wondering if you would speak to some of the specific applications of CEDAW to improve representation for women in all spaces more generally, but also specifically in peace processes and following direct conflict. Maybe Dr. Hofmeister, if it's referenced in general recommendation number 30 coming up, which I believe was on conflict and post-conflict.
Okay. Did you get that?
No.
Okay. essentially, women's participation, the importance of women's participation, provisions of CEDAW relating to women's participation in general and in particular in the context of peace negotiations.
Yeah.
Okay. And behind you.
Thanks. So it's just about reservations to the treaty. I think this is
here is the expert on reservations.
So I don't know. I think, unless I'm wrong, it's the treaty with most reservations or something. Yeah, sadly. I was wondering if you thought it was better to have as many countries signed up as possible, even though they've got some of them have so many reservations that the treaty is almost kind of meaningless, or you think it would be better to have fewer countries and have them all signed up completely?
Okay, so that was reservations and the issue of whether it is better to have countries with reservations signed up or whether it is better for a country to remain outside the convention rather than become a party with reservations. So it's the reservations issue, essentially. We'll come here. We'll take one more now. Turn back to Jane and Lillian and then come round for a second round afterwards.
My name is Kahramana Kakar, and I'm a freelance researcher at the moment. My question is from both of you. The definition of war, in my perspective, is very important in order to identify the status of a country, a conflict country or a post-conflict country, and its ability to implement treaties, conventions, and resolutions such as the CEDAW, and to decide on which particular instrument should be implemented. How often do you come across such challenges where you expect a country to be implementing the treaties like or conventions like CEDAW and the UNSCR 1325, but they fail to do so? How often do you face these challenges with the countries, with the governments?
Okay, I think you've said a lot of questions there. Mm-hmm. So essentially, the definition of war, yes? How do we understand war with respect to the application of particular treaties, particular instruments? And how often, in particular, how often does conflict prevent the application of the treaty?
How often do you come across the challenges with a mutual understanding with the government and or with a country which is in conflict or in a post-conflict situation? But how often do you face that they are not doing what they are supposed to be doing?
So how often do you find that the country is essentially in conflict with its obligations under the convention? Yeah? Okay, Jane. I was going to say kick off, but with the Rugby World Cup going on at the moment, maybe we better have a different image.
Yes, not kicking.
Not kicking.
On the reservations thing first, indeed it was the treaty to which there were the most reservations at one point. But it could be said it's the treaty to which many reservations have been removed. So as things went on, and you found many ratification or accession in most countries was very hard. So you see the discussions in Australia, New Zealand, a country like the United Kingdom, it was very, very difficult. And the only way ratification could occur is if there were reservations. And as things moved, as the committee discussed, and I'll get to another point in a minute, they were lifted. But we now have a group of fairly stubborn states. Well, they're not stubborn. They've got fixed views about certain things, and I go back to marriage and the family. And they retain their reservations, and I think it's highly unlikely that they will remove them, except they may narrow them to a certain extent, and from my point of view, it's valuable to have them inside the discussion. The whole idea is a discussion. And what strikes me is, you know, I always talk about theory and practice, and I was talking about this with Elizabeth on another topic. Much of the value of this treaty is in empowering or providing a space for those who want to see a change in their countries, even in situations of conflict, to occupy that space and discuss those issues. And though you might think that 1325, CEDAW and so on are pieces of paper, that they have allowed women, in particular from countries which don't have really democratic institutions, to use the UN as a focus and to discuss their issues. And if you go to a CEDAW session, you will find the 22 women and one man, and what you will also find is a huge number of men and women who are following the work of the CEDAW committee, and this also occurs in the case of other committees, who see the value in it in terms of moving things on the ground. I just don't believe that states are going to be that enthusiastic about the treaty unless you have a push. And this applies to many of the questions that have been posed. And you do see things change, and you have to take a long view, unfortunately. It's not going to happen overnight. And 1325, people forgot 1325 when they got all enthusiastic about sexual violence in armed conflict. The basic issue is participation, which hasn't really been achieved. But if you have a document like that and you work on it, and I'm sure Christine will, and not focus... It's come back a little bit to the participation, hasn't
it? After it has, yeah.
We've moved off the victimisation back to the participation.
Well, 2122, yes, I think,
yes,
does. Yeah.
Yes, a little bit more. But it's how people use these things. And you see, you're the people who'll be telling people about these things and encouraging them to use these things in their own way.
Lillian.
Yes. I would like to answer the question concerning peace negotiations. For my opinion, all countries, and especially the UN, have a watchdog function during these proceedings. And I think it's very important that the military service have also women, and also the reconstructed parliaments have a big amount of women, a good quota. How it works, I cannot say, because I didn't have any case in this direction. Yes. When is a conflict a conflict? You find the definition in General Recommendation number 30. It's a broad definition. States and non-state actors are included. But also, I will tell you, in addition, the recommendation covers other situations of concern, such as internal communal violence, states of emergency and suppression of mass uprisings, war against terrorism and organized crime, which may not necessarily be classified as armed conflict under international humanitarian law, and which result in serious violations of women's rights and are of particular concern to the committee. Yes? How it works, I don't know.
So CEDAW has a much broader definition than the general international law definition of conflict. What about the issue of states who are reporting who are clearly in violation? How does the committee handle that?
Who are Which in a conflict?
Or conflict or not conflict, either.
Yes. I don't know it, because I had no state which was in a conflict. Yes.
What about generally, if they were in violation of the convention?
Yes, I think in generally the committee will focus on this point, yes, and their concluding observations. Yes. But it's written paper, sorry. Yes?
So at one point, the committee did call states who were in conflict situations before it, exceptionally.
Yes. Bosnia, yeah.
So all of the states of the former Yugoslavia, except Slovenia, I suppose, and Macedonia, were called to provide exceptional reports. Also India, with regard to Gujarat and the DRC. And they were little pieces of paper, but it brought these states before it. This allowed for focus to be placed on these states, and focus to be placed on these states in the context of the issues that were affecting women. Yeah. And I think you would not have had that had it not been for the committee doing that. And I wondered why the committee mightn't think of doing it again. And also it has its inquiry function, which then again provides this opportunity to highlight sort of aspects. I think in terms of its concluding observation, it's dialogue with states. It's a dialogue with states. It's not... although people call these monitoring bodies, the notion is to assist states with implementation. So it is very practical, it's very pragmatic, and tries to push them along. I don't think it's going to bring a state out of conflict, but it will contribute and it will highlight issues that mightn't be highlighted by others. I doubt whether we have the Security Council talking about the situation of women. There'll be a tiny paragraph, but there won't be that focus that you can have with this committee.
Or bring the specialised knowledge
exactly
of the committee.
So, yeah, exactly so. And, of course, members of the committee, there have been many members over the years, have been part of conflict. So we had a member from Timor-Leste, for example. We've had members from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So they have that expertise that they're able to put in place.
But then I think it's very important for the media to be
right.
informed about this development, yes. Mm-hmm. And to make a public space for the problems.
Right, next round. Up at the back. Very back.
Thank you very much. My name is Zainab Assawi. I'm a Sudanese women's rights activist. I have very similar question, but I guess all of them are technical to some extent. My first one, for monitoring and evaluation, for countries who are already implementing CEDAW, does the committee has any mechanism to compare reports presented from the civil society against reports from the government or not? This is the first question.
So the shadow reporting.
Shadow reports, yeah.
Shadow reports from
civil society, yeah.
We also meet delegations of NGOs. We meet them and we discuss and interview them.
Yeah, yes. And then what? My question is, what is there any mechanisms to deal with it completely contradicting knowledge between the government and the civil society? My second question, for the countries who rejected to sign or ratify CEDAW, I know there are very few of them. My country is one of them. And there is also Somaliland. I'm not sure about the states, if they signed or not. I'm from Sudan.
And not signed also?
No, nothing.
No.
My question is there any efforts for those government? Is there any hope that the committee might be able to convince them? That was 10 years ago. I was working for the Netherlands Embassy in Khartoum as a gender advisor. And I remember one of the committee member came to Sudan and met the government and the civil society. But I don't know what's the outcome of these kinds of discussions.
So does the committee make efforts to try?
You know it? I don't know.
I know what happened with this case, and I also know that I gave copies of reservations to the Sudanese government in Arabic about 50 times.
Oh.
Because they're taking it extremely seriously, and therefore you need to do it every year.
So we give up.
Later. No, we do not give up. We push.
Yeah, we continue pushing.
A couple of committee members went. Naila Garb went to Sudan to discuss. Yes, some years ago.
Okay, I think because there's a lot of other people. Okay, so thank you very much, guys. There's so many hands. Over here, we'll take three. Over here, and then we'll come back to this side, and then to the middle.
Hello, I'm Lisa Gormley. I'm an independent lawyer working on women's rights. I had a question, maybe more for Jane, but also for Lillian. And it's going back to Jane, what you were talking about in terms of the political comments from the Gulf Cooperation countries, Iran, Holy See, African Group, about sexual and reproductive rights, LGBT rights, etc. And I spend a lot of time looking at CEDAW general comments, and you know, the committee is very persistent in its views, and also those views are shared by the sibling committees. I mean, if you look at the I think it's General Comment 28 of Human Rights Committee on the core legal obligations. It's very strong on non-discrimination. And so I wondered, to what extent do you see this as kind of political posturing, or is it just for show, or do we have something different going on in the reality of the treaty body world? And also a question, and maybe it's just to follow up some of the other ones, but to ask you to reflect a bit more on when does CEDAW work? When does that space that civil society members take, when does that become effective, and when does implementation really work?
When does CEDAW become most
effective?
Thank you. Essentially. There was somebody over this side. Yes?
No. Hi, thanks. My name is Tessa. I'm also Austrian, so I'm quite happy to have you here. I was recently writing or co-authoring a chapter on the Migrant Workers Convention, which is a little bit of a stepchild, unfortunately. And one of the arguments that we looked into the CEDAW individual complaints mechanism as well, and CEDAW seems to be quite active in taking in complaints also from women migrant workers. So I was wondering whether you think that if the Migrant Workers Convention managed to establish their individual complaints mechanism, whether there would be an added value for women migrant workers, or whether CEDAW basically is the best we can achieve in terms of international access to justice for women migrant workers.
I don't know, sorry.
Okay, and we'll come down here.
A bit of following on from the migrant workers. I'm Susie Billings. I'm a student at SOAS doing gender and law.
Sorry, can you wait for the...
Following on from the migrant worker question, my name is Susie Billings. I'm a student at SOAS studying gender and law. I've been living and working in Qatar for the last 8.5 years, and I know there's a Qatari member on the expert committee. Indonesia, just this last week, has published that in order to protect its female citizens, that it is going to stop them working in many of the GCC countries because there is an ongoing issue of violence against domestic workers. So there was kind of a multiple-part question. You might be able to summarize it in one. Does Indonesia as a state work through CEDAW at all to try and address this? Or is it something that they've just done independently with no hope of change within the GCC states? And I know that it's not a problem just for Indonesian workers, but for Filipinas, for, you know, a variety of nationalities of women working in the home where there's very little labor laws. And together with that, you mentioned at the beginning that I think that the CEDAW experts only got together for 2 weeks a year. What is the time frame now, and how much do you get to know and learn from each other, and does that actually help people advocate back in their home countries and to have GCC representatives on the committee? So too many questions, I'm sorry.
Okay, so essentially a group around migrant workers. So is there a value added if the Migrant Workers Convention had an individual complaints mechanism as well? Or is the CEDAW committee, you know, with its general recommendation on migrant workers and its overall approach, is that effective with respect to migrant workers? And then further, the timing of how long do you sit now? And to what extent...
Three times a year for 4 or 5 weeks.
And to what extent, I think really you were asking, to what extent is there a sort of a group identity among the committee? How much do you support each other, develop an ethos, in effect?
I'm a newcomer. I'm a baby. And so I cannot answer this question. But my opinion, my experience is with other members that they are in a good coordination and they work together. But not me. I can only look at them in my first year. It's too complicated to jump in.
It's a very complex treaty.
Yes. But the group, the female group, is very good. religion is no problem, political positions are no problem. Most of them are feminists. You spoke about the lady from Qatar. She also came with me as a newcomer. She is very ambitious. Yes, I think so. It's a good group, yes. But how to work, I will see next year.
Jane, any of the other questions? Value added of the when you have two treaties on similar issues?
Well, I would call the Committee on the Convention on Migrant Workers a foundling rather than a stepchild. I think the likelihood of there ever being the communications procedure entering into force is pretty remote. And what would be very useful is to consider ways of strengthening the committee. If what you're going to have is 45, you know, you're going to have 45 states or whatever you have, you need to see that you have very, very good members who can do something different. Maybe they can develop notions with regard to migration, they can work on general recommendations or something of that nature, because they're not going to get very far unless there's an enormous cataclysm relating to the European Union and other countries, and I'm not seeing that any time soon, but you never know. With regard to your question, I think you've got to see all of these things in a very, very wide context. The treaty bodies are only part of the issues with regard to the family. And you do know that there is now a perennial, annual resolution of the Human Rights Council on is it the family and whatever. It's quite a difficult discussion, and it becomes a very, very nasty discussion at some point. So I think you're looking at it in a wider context, and if you look at those statements on the adoption of the SDGs, you might see that something is bubbling there, and something that we mightn't want to see. With regard to the impact of the committee, there's been such impact that it's extraordinary, and you can see it with regard to cases at the national level, though there was an Austrian one which didn't go down so well, it wasn't there, but the cases at the national level have picked up on general recommendations, in particular general recommendation 19, and you see that they've picked up on the outcome of petitions, and there have been more or less, I mean, half of them, 20 plus, have been very good views on petitions. I was in Macedonia, strangely enough, the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, I apologise, a couple of weeks ago, and their legislation on domestic violence, in fact, uses the very definition of what is gender-based violence from General Recommendation 19. So I think, and there I was working with judges. So they're seeing that. So this happens. And it's not going to happen fast, but it happens. And I think you really do have to take a long view, and you really have to see how things change and change and change. And individual women in particular. I have a friend who works. She founded a non-governmental organisation which follows CEDAW, in fact is more or less at the front line in following CEDAW, IROR Asia Pacific. And she spoke to me once about some training that she'd given to women, Malaysian women, who, you know, from various backgrounds and so on and so forth. And one was a victim of violence from her husband. And learning about CEDAW, you can't believe this really, but it does happen. He attempted to hit her, and she stood up, a little woman, and she said, "Don't you hit me." And he said, "What's going on?" And she says, "It's the new Padma." And this, it's strange what people can be strengthened by. Mm-hmm. Yes. And you can't underrate knowing that you have rights in an international convention can be very, very empowering.
Probably time for two more very quick questions and very quick answers. You were very quick on it, so yeah.
Okay. Hi, I'm Amr, and I'm a student at the Gender Institute at LSE. I just wanted to ask about the clarification between monitoring and evaluation and follow-up for countries that sort of sign on to CEDAW, but then also countries that, like you're talking about in Macedonia, that kind of adopt principles of CEDA and domestic laws. And when I think about this, I think about the case of India, because the Indian constitution, I think Article 32, sort of lets India ratify any sort of international treaty it's a part of as a part of their national law. And the women's movement actually used this to pass a really sort of profound law about sexual harassment in the workplace called the Vishaka Guidelines. And the Vishaka Guidelines are essentially all kind of CEDAW rhetoric. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that, like, it was very influential, but in practice, it doesn't really go far. And I was wondering how, when you have something so specific in a country very tied to this larger body of sort of gender legal framework, how does CEDA work at that level?
So the relationship between international and national. Mm-hmm. And, okay, we have one last one. Okay, and there's a real claim over here as well, so we'll take one there as well, last one.
Hi, I'm Lindsay. I'm a student at LSE studying inequality. My question kind of stems from what you said, Jane, about the sort of resurgence of that age-old headache that human rights are not universal but can be viewed through a lens of religion, culture, etc. What does CEDAW, can you give kind of an example of that and how CEDAW, either one of you, can address that, and maybe like a modern example of that? And how they're addressing it?
The Article 5 issue, essentially.
Sorry.
Okay. And one last one. How does CEDAW address the relationship between universality and culture, religion? The Article 5.
Hello, my name is Sangeeta. I'm a gender student at LSE. Sorry, I'm not feeling so well today. My question is regarding Nepal, because that's where I'm from. So in regards to the recent constitution that was promulgated in Nepal, they have denied women the right to pass their citizenship to their children on an equal basis as male citizens. But Nepal has ratified CEDAW in 1991 without any reservation. And there was a huge women's movement as well, and it was a transition phase. It was an opportunity to create a new constitution for the country. Yet despite that, women don't still have the right to pass the citizenship to their children. So I was just thinking, in that particular context, what would the way forward be? Not just in terms of using CEDAW as a method to advocate further, but what can be done to actually change the situation? Because I think from a women's movement point of view, most of the things were done, but the changes didn't really take place.
So the issue of Nepal's nationality law, the fact that women cannot transfer their nationality to their children, Article 9, essentially. Jane, do you want to make two or three very brief final comments, and then Lillian will give the last word to you?
I think my brief comment is about the India issue. I think the thing that you have to always keep in mind is that states are not homogenous. You're going to have people within states, so within administrations. And Vishaka came, of course, from a Supreme Court decision, did it not? So, the guidelines came from... So a judge... was happy to pick up on the CEDAW guidelines and move forward. So there's no easy answer, but just bear in mind that people are all very, there are different, the legislature will not be homogenous, the judiciary will not be homogenous, so you will get some form of cracking at some point. With regard to Nepal, I think we have to go back to Sapna and ask her what she's going to do about these sorts of things. So, it essentially requires work from your people within.
And final word?
Yes. Women's rights are universal, human rights, and Article 5 emphasizes the priority of CEDAW against cultural specific matters and issues. Yes, and CEDAW is number one.
So my question would be: what sort of conflicts do you see
Have you had...
Coming from that, how do you kind of overcome that resurgence of that idea, I guess?
Have you any examples that have come towards CEDAW of such a conflict? Jane?
I think one thing that's interesting is there's never been any... with regard to states which have reservations, for example, on these particular areas, the committee is not fazed about that. The committee will ask questions about those areas. Say you've got a reservation to Article 2, Article 9, or Article 60. The committee will ask those states those questions in a probing, non-confrontational way. And there's never been a state which has said... I'm not prepared to address those questions because those provisions are not binding on our state because we have reserved. So I think it's a dialogue, and it's not so much a monitoring, but it's assisting in implementation. And always look at the text. I mean, there's no mention of monitoring anywhere. So if you think of things in that way, you can develop. Of course, in some areas, things are hopeless, but you need to also be a little bit optimistic.
Do you want a final word about optimism?
No. Okay, I think we're bang on 8 o'clock. Before I thank the speakers, which will be my last task, invite you to any further events from the Centre of the Centre for Women, Peace and Security. So tomorrow lunchtime, we're having what we hope to be the first of a series of conversations. So tomorrow we're having a conversation with Dr. Marcia Henry, who's going to be in conversation with Professor Cynthia Enloe, a well-known feminist international relations scholar. This is at 12:30 in the NAB room 104. So you're all invited to that. And on the 9th of November, we have another conversation between the founder of an NGO, Women for Women International, Zainab Serbi, and the Foreign Minister of Sweden, entitled Towards a Feminist Foreign Policy, something that Margot Wallström has recently raised as an issue. So you're all invited to both of those events. I think both should be really informative. The Centre's website, which I think is up here somewhere as well, yeah, and also in the leaflet that you've all got, has all the information about the events and further events coming up. Keep in touch via Twitter. And whatever you do with Twitter, I don't know. Do whatever, yeah. But I would especially like to thank, before I finish as well, Monica Zak, who's in the front row, who has done a considerable amount of work in putting the event together this evening. So thank you very much indeed, Monica. And again to the Austrian Embassy for the event and for providing the reception that we're all about to go to. And the reception is on the 8th floor. If you haven't signed, is there a piece of paper to sign with names?
There isn't.
Okay, so we have done that. And so finally, again, I would like to thank all of you for your participation, for your great questions, for making this a really interesting evening, and to both our speakers, again, for coming, for giving such wide-ranging talks around the issues of women's human rights, and for all the work that you do on women's human rights. So both of you. Thank you.